Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
My name is Ben, and we are joined, as always, by our super producer, Noel the Towman Brown.
Super Tug.
Noel Super Tug Brown.
Super Tug, yeah.
Yeah, and that'll make sense as we continue, of course, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, when we use a nickname for Noel, it is an indicator of somewhat what the episode will be about.
Well, and admiration.
Yes,
of course.
Yes.
What we're talking about today is airport support vehicles. So anything and everything at the airport that is powered, I guess, that is not a flying machine.
Yeah. Let's get into it this way, Scott. When's the last time you were in an airport?
Oh, man. Recently. I mean, I guess it would be, maybe a month ago.
Mm-hmm. And when you sit in the plane or when you sit at the terminal and wait for your flight,
yeah.
Do you ever check out the runway and see what the action's like down there?
Oh, I absolutely do. I'm constantly looking out the window. Like, I try to find a seat that's near the window so I can watch what's happening because there's always just so much. It's like a beehive of activity all around the terminals.
Mm-hmm.
So I love watching what's happening nearby. I like watching as far as you can see, you know, across an airport. Usually it's very flat and open.
Right.
So, you know, you're able to have a pretty good view of what's happening on the other side of the field as well, like moving planes between hangars or towing giant planes, you know, on runways that aren't being used for flights arriving or departure.
Tractors fueling up.
Yeah. Oh, that too. Yep. Or in colder climates, I remember loving to watch when they do the de-icing. That's really fascinating to watch. And people in the South don't typically get to see that unless they head up to, you know, the northern climates where, you know, that's something that's a little more common, but it's a pretty cool thing to watch.
Right. You know, I've seen the same thing, Scott, whenever I'm at an airport. I watch what appears to be chaos, you know, over time. If you watch it long enough, you can see the rhythm, you can feel the pattern of the way these vehicles move and interact together.
It's mostly orchestrated, I think. I think there's a little bit of confusion here and there, but that's probably just because of the volume, especially at something like, you know, the Atlanta airport.
Hartsfield-Jackson Airport is one of the most busy airports in the world.
Yeah, it may be the busiest airport in the world.
As a
matter of fact, I think it is.
Depending on how you define it, like civilian, military, commercial.
Sure.
Yeah. So it is true that it's a huge airport, and we'll talk a little bit about the massive amounts of vehicles that you, the airport passenger, or the airplane passenger rather, may never get to see. But before we continue, there's something very important. We should thank somebody for this idea because it was not ours.
Exactly. Actually, a couple of people, and I'm going to throw in a third just because here. But the first suggestion came from someone named Sanya K. And I hope I'm saying Sanya's name right. It might be Sanya K. And this is a Facebook conversation. And Sanya wrote in and said, "Hey, guys, have you ever done an episode about airport vehicles? I was recently traveling and was looking at all these weird-looking vehicles that they have. And it made me think that these vehicles are very specific and were designed specifically for the airports. I don't think they can be used anywhere but the airport." And I think Sanya's right. Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Another listener wrote in a Facebook message. The guy's name is Dick B. And the note says, "I'm enclosing a few shots that I took during my career of working snow at an international airport around New York City." I think we can guess maybe which one that is, right?
Right.
He says, "I think this type of equipment would make a good topic for a show." Now, Dick, we're not going to go specifically into just the snow equipment, but we are going to mention that as part of this because that's a huge part of the equipment that they have to keep and maintain there.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we're going to touch on it in depth enough, you know, for you in this case, because, man, Ben, there were so many vehicles as we went through this. One last thing that I want to mention here is another listener that had written in something about an aircraft tug. Do you remember maybe who this was? Just a random guess, possibly. Any guess?
Was it Rudy?
No, it was not Rudy.
It wasn't Rudy.
Although he may at some point have mentioned that along the way, but the most recent example, this came from Clayton, and Clayton wrote in with his, you know, his kind of maybe one or two line reviews of a bunch of vehicles that a lot of people really liked, and I think he may be providing us with a few more of those.
Oh, great.
kind of been messaging him back and forth about what's going on with that, and he's still driving. So he may be sending some more.
And but, we've been receiving some great reviews from you, ladies and gentlemen, about your own cars.
Oh, yeah, we have. Lots of good notes.
Good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, a little bit of everything, just like we asked for, right?
Uh-huh.
All right, so you remember Clayton is from the South Texas area, and he drives vehicles for manufacturers kind of testing, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing that he mentioned in that last note was that he had driven an aircraft tug. And the aircraft tug, he says, I don't know the make or the year or anything like that, but it had loads of torque. It was extremely fast off the line for the first 5 feet, and that was it.
Huh.
So very, very short review of that one, and I don't think he really put any mileage on it, just maybe riding around on the lot there or something.
Right.
But it sounds like fun. I'd love to try my hand at one of those at some point.
These would all be kind of fun to drive.
I think you're right. I think just about everything on this list I would like to give a shot.
All right, where do we want to start?
Well, boy, we can just kind of go to – well. Okay, there's motorized and non-motorized. I don't know if we need to cover the non-motorized stuff, but it's things like dollies and carts and things like that.
Right,
so that's
right.
All understood, that there's equipment. But the powered equipment, that's what we're talking about. Maybe fuel trucks, like the two different types of fuel trucks?
Oh, yeah. So they can be either self-contained or they can be like a hydrant truck.
Yeah. Now, I got to admit, I don't know if I've ever seen a hydrant truck in action. Maybe I saw one and didn't realize it, though.
Yeah.
The difference is that self-contained, that's pretty obvious. I mean, it carries its own fuel. You have to, you know, take it somewhere and fill the
Tank.
Fill the tank, of course, yeah. But it has its own filters and pumps and hoses and all that. But they can carry a huge amount of fuel.
Oh, yeah.
Like 10,000 gallons of fuel in some cases, if you're talking about a big tanker.
Airplanes are thirsty beasts, my friend.
They definitely are. But the hydrant trucks, now these, I'm not sure if I've ever seen one, but there's a central pipeline network that runs throughout the airport, and these can hook up to that. And then basically what the truck is just a pump to facilitate getting it from the pipeline to the plane.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like a movable, it's pretty much a movable hose.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. A pump with two hoses attached, maybe. That's a better way to think of it.
Yeah.
The pump in between. You know, I've been thinking about these fuel trucks and God, some of these older ones, like the really cool old, almost streamlined looking ones that you see in a lot of the Tumblr pages or, you know, stuff what I've been posting on our Facebook page. Some of the really, really unique, cool. Well, they weren't unique at the time, but now they are.
Yeah,
that they still exist. But some of the really, really interesting designs that have come along the way, they don't seem to have that anymore. It's a little more squared off. It's a little more utilitarian,
industrial looking.
Yeah, industrial is a good way to put it, Ben.
Right, and it should go without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that these gas tankers are integral to the operation of any airport, especially an airplane. You might see them from your window, depending on where you're seated in the plane as the tanker rolls under the wing, right? But what you'll be more likely to see will be the tractors and the tugs.
Yeah, those are the things that haul around those little carts that have the baggage and
the dollies.
Yeah, they haul around way more than that. Sometimes it's just moving people. Sometimes it's moving equipment or you know, like we said, cargo of some kind.
And sometimes they're moving planes.
Well, sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. If it's a small enough plane, these tugs and tractors can do that. Now, tugs, there's a different type of tug that we're going to get to a little bit later, a pushback tug that we'll talk about. But and those are more specialized, I think. But tugs definitely have the power to move big, big items. I mean, it's all in how it's towed, too. I mean, there's a trick to all this, and we'll tell you about that along the way, too, in how these small machines, because that's, I think, a question that a lot of people have, how these small machines, relatively small machines, can move so much weight. They haul so much, and it's incredible to see what they do. They're real workhorses. And, again, all this stuff has to be moved around somehow, and these tugs and tractors are a perfect way to do that. Now, the next thing that I want to mention here is something called a ground power unit, or GPU.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what supplies electrical power to the aircraft when it's parked on the ground. So, you know, when the engines aren't spooled up and they aren't producing their own electricity on board.
Right.
This is the way that all the accessories, all the auxiliary stuff is powered when they're parked.
And they need a lot of electricity. They need like 28 volts of direct current, 115 volts, 400 hertz of alternating current. So they need both DC and AC.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's a couple of ways they can do this. Now, we've talked about these are mobile units that we're thinking about specifically, but there can also be stationary units that are built into the jetway and, you know, can just be plugged directly into the plane. And that's a possibility. It's probably more common, I would say, to find, at this point right now, and anyways, at least the ones I've seen, to see a GPU that is mobile, you know, that can pull up to a plane.
Right.
Also, this is an interesting thing to mention too, is that you may think that when they travel, you know, from airport to airport around the world, that there's going to be some problems with the plugs. Because like you and I travel, and if we were to go to Ireland or we were to go to Africa or wherever, anywhere in the
China,
world.
Wherever.
Yeah, that we would not expect to be able to just plug any device into the wall because there's no standardized version of that plug, right?
Right.
Everybody has their own different receptacle and well, anyways, you can buy those travel kits that have the adapters.
The adapters, yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's not necessary for planes, though, because there is an ISO standard that makes all these connections for aircraft universal.
Right. And this means that wherever you go around the world, these GPUs are going to be able to work with an aircraft. Also, I believe all aircraft are required to have the cable that connects to the GPU aboard the plane.
Oh, really? So they don't provide the cable at the airport as well?
Right. This is, I think, such a great argument for standardization because, Scott, you and I have talked, and listeners, you and I have talked over email or Twitter or Facebook about this before, but while it is in a manufacturer's interest at times to have proprietary plugs, you know, on everything from an Apple iPhone to a specific sort of key, right?
Yeah.
It's better for the consumer often, and especially in this case, it's safer if there is a universal standard.
Yeah, I mean, how maddening is that when you have a phone charger that doesn't work for, you know, the phone that your friend has in his or her pocket as well? It's frustrating at times when stuff like that happens. Or we can't pass back and forth devices between laptops here in the office.
Right.
Because,
exactly.
A Windows machine versus a Mac. Right?
Uh-huh.
So that's always trouble. I'm sure everybody has a similar
Story with
something,
right? Something
like
that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. What about buses? Now, I've actually been to airports where I've had to hop on a bus, you know, when there's airport construction or something.
They drove you out to the plane on the runway?
Yeah, well, this one was more like between terminals, traveling a long distance, and they don't want you having to walk. This is weird. It was an international flight, and you get off the flight, and we walked a significant distance in the terminal and then out a door onto a bus, and then the bus took us over to the customs or immigration, and you know, for the check through with passports and everything. And I was thinking that as I was looking at this whole setup, you know, you can find flaws with all this stuff. I was thinking, like, that's weird. I mean, anybody could hop on that bus then, but you still had to go through, the customs at that point. So, anyways, I've been on a bus a few times at airports. They're used for moving large groups of people, you know, to and from, whether it's employees or passengers that happen to, you know, need to get to a different terminal or to a remote location where a plane is parked, maybe. That's pretty rare, I would think, that would happen, but it might happen. The next one would be container loaders.
Yeah, these are fascinating, especially if you have an abiding interest in large machines. So they come in various different versions. They're also known as K-loaders or cargo loaders, and they are used to move containers and pallets into and out of airplanes. Pretty simple, right?
I gotta say, I like watching these operate. These are really cool.
Yeah, if you're a fan of shows like How Stuff Works or How It's Made, watching this stuff in operation, it just kind of scratches an itch, and you can see it on YouTube.
And now these are the big flat platform trucks that have two sections. There's like a forward and an aft version, section, I guess, rather.
And they operate independently.
Yeah, and they have huge boxes on top, which are typically filled with your luggage, or could be cargo, you know, if it's a cargo plane. But I guess we're talking about mainly passenger planes here. So this is where your luggage is stored in these boxes. And so there's no need
to. The box is called unit load devices.
Oh, okay. There, right. Thank you. And instead of just kind of heave-hoing all of your luggage into the hold beneath the plane, they put it into these boxes and pack it away neatly. And they know which box contains which, which pieces of luggage and all
right.
that. It's all
documented.
In theory,
hopefully.
In theory, that's right. And I've been on flights before where they're trying to find someone's bag and they don't know what box it's in. That's also trouble.
And it has these powered rollers that help to shift and move these UDLs, or excuse me, ULDs, the unit load devices.
Yeah, and they're really cool. So, like, imagine it just lifts straight up, and it allows it to kind of shuttle that box straight into the hold of the plane, and then on the other end, they can remove it in exactly the same way. It's really a great setup. It's very cool to watch.
And some of these, in military applications, can be airborne loaders, which doesn't mean they can fly. I know how cool that would be. What it means is that once they load stuff, they also load themselves or get loaded onto the plane.
Makes sense, right? Because you never know where a military plane is going to land. It could be out in the desert somewhere.
I know.
And there's no way to get that cargo off the ship.
Could be Diego Garcia or something.
Could be. All right, so here's one that's not typical in the U.S., but it's found elsewhere in the world, and this is a transporter. The transporters are kind of a cargo platform-type vehicle that can load and unload characters, just like we said, but it also transports the cargo. Now, that's the difference here is that the other one that we just talked about
just loads it.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really haul it around. So this one can take it long distances. You know, if it has to go across the runway to another hangar or, you know, wherever, it just can take it. And I say long distances, I mean on the property.
It looks like a moving sidewalk that is also a car.
Yeah, it's a pretty neat-looking device, really. Yeah. I mean, or machine, rather. I'd kind of like to drive one of those. Hey, you know what? I don't think there's many vehicles here that we're talking about today that I wouldn't want to drive, really.
No.
The responsibility would be great.
Well, and there are very few that would be in any way street legal. The buses, but I don't think you could take – I don't think you and I could take a transporter out. On even on a side road.
Yeah, and even the buses, you know, those things are they're very specialized, and I don't even know if they're street legal, really. Sometimes they will use a city bus, but a lot of times, you know, we didn't mention this, but they're built with a low roof, so they get under wings if they have to. They have like wide aisles, and they have low load platforms. So I don't know if that's the right term, but low floors, I guess maybe
the low platform. Yeah,
yes.
So that it's easier to enter in and out with heavy amounts of luggage.
Exactly. Yeah, it's critical.
Storage
too.
Racks.
Yeah, like a little different than a city bus. It's got more storage, really.
And also, you know, it's strange when you think about all the traffic on a roadway. We have to, or all the traffic on a rampway, rather. We have to remember that. All of these vehicles, many of which are not that fast, are very, very nimbly moving around gigantic planes.
Yeah, sometimes planes that can't see them underneath. Mm-hmm. So it's critical. The training part of this whole thing would be fascinating to learn, like because it's very regimented in where they can and can't go. And the rules of the road are a little bit different there. I don't know who has right of way in certain places or what, but I would bet the training is pretty intense for something like this. At least you would hope it would be. And some of these, of course, you know, require a lot more training than others. I mean, I don't know how hard it would be to drive a bus versus, say, driving, you know, some of the more specialized safety equipment that we're going to talk about later.
Right.
So I find it all very fascinating anyways. I mean, I think all of this is really interesting, and there's so many different directions that we could go with this for another episode, even if we wanted to.
I think we should take a closer look at the ASU, or Air Start Unit.
Oh, this is a pretty cool thing, too. Now, this one actually starts the engines of the plane.
Right. And it starts them because it has a built-in gas turbine engine of its own, and this provides the right amount of high-pressure air needed to start the plane's engines.
Yes, and I guess this This ASU is used when the APU, which is on board the plane, the auxiliary power unit, is not operational. So this air starter blows air in by one or two hoses that are attached to the aircraft, and that's what provides that high pressure, that amount of high pressure that's necessary to get those engines cranking.
Exactly.
Something they can't do on their own, I suppose.
So they need that high pressure air, but there's also something else they need, and that would be water.
Yeah, exactly right. Of course, we need clean water because you know they do cooking on board. They make coffee and tea and things like that, right? So they need clean water or potable water, as they say. And the thing about these trucks is that the trucks themselves, you know, they protect them from protect the water from the elements. You know, it's not like they hook up a garden hose to the plane or something, but it's filtered and stored in the vehicle, so it's clean, drinkable water that's carried on board these things. Nothing too out of the ordinary of it, you know, about it than any other truck, really, I wouldn't think. Probably just a pump system that gets it on board as much as they need.
And while they're bringing some stuff on board a plane when it lands, they have to take some stuff off.
Oh, Ben. This
might be the one you wouldn't want to drive.
Maybe it's not as gross as you think, really. I mean, because, you know, they do their best. Of course, you're not going to come into contact with this, but we're talking about the lavatory service vehicles. And of course, that's a dirty job. I get it, but I'm sure that there are safety precautions in place because they're not going to have people come into direct contact with that
stuff. Right. Yeah. You attach a waste hose to the plane. And it's, you know, I think it's on the underbelly near the where this connection to the waste tank is.
It's got to be a lot like emptying an RV system or something like that, right? Or a bus. Mm-hmm. It's got to be very, very similar, if not identical to that.
And they don't just empty it. They wash it out, too. After they empty it, it gets refilled with water and a disinfectant.
Yeah, the disinfectant that they call the blue juice, right?
The blue juice.
Yeah, so everybody knows when you go on a plane, there's that that intensely blue water that they use, and they call that blue juice. And that's disinfectant. It's a cleaner that is intended for, well, it's a lot of things. It keeps the facilities clean in a general sense.
Yeah.
And it also helps to neutralize some of whatever's going on in
keeps
there.
Keeps things looking good.
Exactly right. And, you know, we should have another topic about, or another discussion maybe later about, blue ice. Because there's always this thought that
it's like an urban legend.
Well, it kind of is. Like they're dumping the reservoirs when they're over water or something like that. That's not the case. They don't do that. They bring it to the airport and it's handled in a sanitary way. But there are cases where sometimes the system will develop a leak, like that valve has a little leak, and that's a problem when you're at 35,000 feet because it's going to freeze and it's going to make an icicle, which turns into a clump, and then that clump can break free and come down to earth and cause quite a bit of problems. I mean, there are cases of, orange-sized globs of what they call blue ice landing, going through a roof of a house.
Right.
I mean, because it falls a long, long way and it's still frozen when it gets here. But blue ice could be a problem, but it's very rare when that happens.
And
it's always a mistake.
It's an accident. Yeah. Pilots have no ability to, you know, they don't have a switch that's like ice bomb.
This is reminding me of the Dave Matthews Band bus in Chicago, but, that's a completely different thing.
What happened?
Do we really need to talk about that? Maybe we can. It was there was an architectural tour that was on the water, you know, a barge. So people are, you know, having cocktails and dressed up nice and, you know, looking at the city from the river as they float through. The guy that drives the, this is awful. The guy that drives the Dave Matthews Band bus stopped on the bridge to empty the tanks in the RV. And a lot of these people, like, as he emptied it, the barge came from the opposite direction under the bridge, and he didn't see it.
Oh, terrible.
And poured it all over the barge and people, and it was just terrible. There were some really awful reports.
Oh, so gross.
People were saying, like, I had my mouth open. Oh, it was just awful, you know, because they're looking up. They're all looking up at the architect. Anyways, okay, it's a bad story.
Oh, boy.
All right, so let's move on to something a little more pleasant, the catering vehicles.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so, of course, when you are on a plane, one of the things that everyone looks forward to is having some kind of snack, whether it's a little bit of cashews or they do pretzels a lot now.
I got to tell you, Ben, I never look forward to having a snack on a plane. You know, it sounds good when you're there, but then what you get is the reality of the situation is that it's typically not all that great.
And the altitude messes with our ability to sense taste.
Isn't that weird how that happens?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's strange. Even though it's a pressurized environment, and you would think that it wouldn't do that, but it does. It affects your taste. So maybe that airline food is better on the ground than it is in the air, but some of my experiences with sandwiches and things like that, or back in the days of, you know, the hot food service a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
That's long gone, by the way, but in most cases. I know there's exceptions.
Yeah, you'll get, in most cases, unless you're paying for a high dollar business class or first class flight, if you have a hot food option, it's going to be microwaved, essentially chilled and reheated, but prepared on the ground.
And then reheated maybe in the air, or kept warm for, you know, in the kitchen or the galley, I guess. But these are really actually pretty simple. And the thing is that these are on the ground; they're very well insulated. I mean, really well insulated.
Yeah.
And the idea on the ground is that they keep the food cool.
Mm-hmm.
So they're refrigerated trucks, and then when they get on the plane, I think is when they do heat the stuff in the kitchen.
Right, and the trailer of the truck where these carts of food are kept, it's so cool because the trailer is on this lift, and it will rise to the side of the aircraft, and then a bridge will open up, and it's easy peasy, right? Roll the cart in.
You know what? This one is close to as much fun as watching the other ones. The The container loaders.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to watching something like that. It's really cool how it lifts up. It's such a, I mean, really, really high, because some of these planes are really big that they're loading and unloading from.
Yeah, and I was surprised that Mercedes-Benz builds these.
Yeah.
Well, builds a lot of these.
You know, I guess for durability, because you'll find that, you know, I was going to talk about this later, but we can talk about it now. Most of these vehicles that we're talking about will last decades and decades and decades on the property. And they don't typically like to get rid of vehicles because, one, it's expensive to buy new vehicles every few years.
Especially such specialized vehicles.
Yeah, so you buy heavy-duty stuff and make sure that it's familiar to the ground service crew that maintains these. So that's another thing, is that, you know, if you're constantly changing the type of vehicle that you're getting in, the mechanics aren't going to know, you know, how to fix things as quickly. You know, they'll have to adapt to a new set of vehicles, a new set of
standards.
Yeah, like maintenance standards. You're exactly right. So, all right. So catering vehicles, that's pretty much done with, I think. And what about belt loaders?
Belt loaders are pretty cool. So what
fun
they
to watch.
Do, yeah, they're used for the narrow aircraft or the narrow body aircraft. And they also will handle the bulk hold, I don't know why that's so hard for me to say, of wide-body aircraft. If you stow baggage without those containers, that's known as bulk loading. So what these are, you've probably seen these. You may have seen these. These are vehicles that look like a truck with a diagonal sidewalk or belt, revolving belt attached to where the passenger side of the cab would be.
Yeah, that can be raised or lowered at whatever degree angle you need, right? You
know, right.
So it could have a very gentle angle or whatnot.
Oh, but, yeah, that's right. They can go flat, but they usually go up. And this helps to bring the luggage down, or bring the cargo down, rather, in theory, again, minimizing damage.
Yeah, I kind of like watching this too, but it's also a little bit maddening to watch this happen, because that's the point where your luggage is really being thrown around the most, I think.
Right.
On and off of that that belt loader, but I got so many stories about my bag. I was watching my bag being just
your bag specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
From the plane you saw.
Yeah, I don't know. This was in the actual airport though, and it was in Las Vegas. And there was a jam up on the carousel, you know, in the baggage claim area. Mm-hmm. And for a while, there was a stoppage of the belt. You know, it was blocked up. And my bag happens to be one that is near the top. It's not the one causing the blockage, but it's a big bag. Like if you're going to pack for a week, it's one of those size bags.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's near the top, but it's not at the top. And I can't reach it. You know, I can't get up. I can't climb up onto the belt and get it, but I can see it. And that's angering as well. You know, it's there for like 20 minutes before someone finally walks up from below, you know, like wherever this is coming from. The guy has like a big weight belt on, and I'm standing there, and he grabs my bag, holds it over his head like King Kong holding it above his head or something, and chucks it down the belt like about 10 or 12 feet to my, I guess it'd be my right, his left, onto the belt, and like a show of force, you know, like this. And he threw it down, and everybody's wide-eyed looking at him, and I had to be the one that kind of humbly goes over there and picks up my bag. So, because what am I going to do? Am I going to yell at the guy?
I mean, you should.
Well, I stared at him in disbelief, and I thought about saying something, but what good does that do? I don't know. I was so mad after I left. Like, I probably should have said something, but I didn't. And it was one of those situations where
a manager.
Yeah, there was something. You know, like, I felt bad about it later that I didn't say something. But at the time, I thought it was a smart move not to, because this guy probably could have crushed me like a tin can.
He wouldn't have done it at his job.
You and probably not.
You and I have a different philosophy. If anything, I get in trouble for shooting my mouth off too often.
I held back, and I feel like I've told that story on the show before. Maybe not, because it was years ago, I think. It was startling when it happened. I mean, it was that kind of event. I mean, I can picture it today, but yeah, that's another.
Like King Kong, huh?
Well, it was. It was like that. Yeah, the guy was just like this big hulking kind of guy, like, and he just threw it like a long, long distance.
I don't know.
Loud thud. It was, and then, you know, 3 minutes later, the belt fires up because he was off. You know, he went down below and turned it back on.
What a punk.
Yeah. All right. That's a probably far too long sidebar.
Was this at Hartsfield?
No, this was in Vegas. Las Vegas.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have no influence in Vegas.
You have influence here in Hartsfield?
Moving on.
All right. So, this is a good one.
This is my favorite one, probably.
I think
for some
too.
Reason.
Yeah.
It's the boarding steps, the ramps, that vehicle, the passenger boarding stairs, you might hear them called the stair car, the aircraft steps, or the air stairs. This is just a mobile means to open the doors and get passengers from the aircraft to the ground without using that slide.
And if you're a fan of Arrested Development, you know this intimately by from the Bluth family, right? They had a Bluth company car, rather, that was a stair car. Mm-hmm. And Michael was always warning about hop-ons, you remember?
Yeah.
What did he say? You have to watch out for bridges and hop-ons. He said, you're going to get some hop-ons.
Yeah.
Like, people are just naturally going to jump on the back of this thing and take a ride around town. But it was so funny. That was such a funny series. And them driving that car around, it was just hilarious. It was really, really funny. But there's a really good reason for them. And the thing is, a lot of these can be adjustable as well. They can,
right.
They can vary, where the stairs contact the plane, because they can be anywhere from 5 to 20 feet high, so that's a huge range.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that they have, a big set and a small set, for something that extreme.
And it's not like a fire escape on wheels. They have options. It could be a very nice stairwell.
I was surprised by these options, actually.
Yeah.
I think I've seen some with canopies, but I have never seen any that have heating or the lighting or the last thing, right?
Right. Red carpet for VIP passengers.
Yeah, come on. So you got a set of stairs, and then it's got like a pre-rolled piece of red carpet that they can roll out when the stairs are attached. So mm-hmm. I've never happened to get that kind of treatment at an airport, Ben.
I'm sorry.
Maybe you have.
Hey, dream big.
You did say you have influence there.
Oh, yeah, I have influence, but not carpet related.
So a red carpet set of stairs rolls up to your PJ, which is a private jet.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I didn't need to say that for you, but, for everybody else.
For everybody else.
So that's how you roll, right?
Right, yeah, that's exactly what happens. My feet have never actually touched the ground at Hartsfield. When I get in, when my private limo shows up, mm-hmm. right, then usually what they do is they have one of the valets come with a luggage carrier thing, and I just hop on that.
Yeah.
And then they
push
me around.
You don't want to walk around like a sucker, No.
That'd be like wearing the same clothes twice. Lazio, we're totally kidding. I was a liberal arts major, so I'm pretty much broke.
Likewise, my friend, likewise.
This is probably... Although it's not my personal favorite, this is one of the most fascinating from an engineering perspective.
Yeah, this next one here, these are the pushback tugs or the tractors, or pushback tugs and tractors, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of falls into the normal tugs that we talked about before, but a little different. Now, these are the ones that actually are used to push the aircraft away from the gate when they're ready to leave. And I know that they do that pushback thing, and that's the term they throw around a lot, is that, we count the time of your flight from pushback to this point.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Right, right.
So that's the moment that you start rolling. And the reason that the planes typically don't use their engines to do this, they use a separate vehicle, an auxiliary vehicle, I guess, like this, a pushback tug, is because if they all use their engines to back up when they use reverse thrust. Yeah, yeah, exactly. The reverse thrusters, it would stir up a bunch of dust and dirt that is collected near the building and, around the building, around the terminal. And it would then, in turn, get into the engine and cause malfunctions and, of course, additional wear that's not necessary. I thought that was kind of interesting. Besides that, it might cause damage to the building in some cases, blowing pieces that aren't firmly attached. The thrust on these things is just incredible. I mean, it'll blow buildings apart if they're placed behind it at full thrust. But anyways, these pushback tractors or tugs have to be extremely powerful, and they also have to be extremely heavy.
Right, to the point where they'll even add extra ballast.
Yeah,
right?
You want to know how much ballast they had, Ben? I looked this up.
Yeah, how much?
Well, I looked up some information on specifically on the ballast, and I went to a company a website of a company that sells these pushback tugs. That's very specialized equipment, airline equipment.
Uh-huh.
And they had the spec sheet for a large pushback tug. I mean, it's a big one, a really big one. And you can add on lead ballast kits that bring the vehicle weight these things weigh 65,000 pounds to begin with.
Holy smokes.
65,000. You can add ballast that will bring that weight up to 110,000 pounds. So you can add 45,000 pounds of weight to these in lead shot or, lead blocks that they load on in pallets. And that's how that's moved. But Can you imagine adding something, or can you imagine driving a vehicle that weighs 110,000 pounds? But then again, you're pushing or towing a vehicle that weighs something like, you know, 400,000 pounds or, you know,
so
whatever.
Comparatively.
I guess so. Yeah. It's, you know, they're very strong. And you may think like, well, how does all this happen? How does it work this way? You may think it has the biggest diesel engine you've ever seen in your life. But that's not necessarily the case. They just have really, really, a high amount of torque. And the gearing is so low that they're more for, of course, pulling and pushing than they are for speed.
Right.
It makes perfect sense to anybody who has tried to, like, pull a stump out of the ground using a vehicle. You want a lot of low-end torque. You don't want, you know, the horsepower number doesn't mean a whole lot. You want low-end torque and grip. And that's what the weight is for. It's so that the vehicle remains firmly planted on the ground when it's pushing or pulling this enormous weight.
You know, another cool thing about these guys is that the driver's cabin – when you're reversing, the driver's cabin can actually raise, and then when you're moving forward, it can lower to fit under aircraft.
Oh, that is really cool. That'd be fun to. This would be fun to drive, but like I said, the responsibility of something like this would be incredible.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever heard of this or not, but there's something called a super tug, and that's where I got Noel's nickname earlier. Now super tugs. If you want to, you can go to check out an article on it's on the Jalopnik site. It's a site that they call the Flight Club, which I thought was clever.
Huh.
Flight Club. And a guy that, you know, he's intimately involved with these vehicles. He's somebody who works in an airport or you know, on this equipment in some way. I never got the connection here of exactly, who this person is, but his name is Paul Thompson. And he wrote an article in November of 2014 about these super tugs and how impressive they are. You know, as far as pushback vehicles.
Yeah.
And the super tugs, the way that they're different from a regular tug, is that the regular tugs are very slow. You know, they're very strong, mm-hmm. but they're very slow and, a little more, not as adept at moving the big, big planes. The super tugs are a lot faster and extremely strong. They can move the biggest of the biggest planes. So they can push around, you know, 747s or Airbus A380s. And the way that they operate, this is maybe the most impressive thing. I'd never seen one of these in action before, but there's a video, and you can go to YouTube and search this too if you want, but, they, instead of, you know, attaching to the nose gear of the plane and pushing or pulling that way.
Right.
Super tugs will, kind of surround the nose gear, you know, the front wheel.
Mm-hmm.
The device kind of almost reminds me of the way a repo truck would pick up a car or something, you know, with an arm that moves, and then it will lift the nose of the plane and then drive it that way. So it's not really like a trailer attachment at that point. It's actually almost part of it, really.
It's towing.
It's towing, but it lifts the front end of a, you know, 747 or an Airbus A380.
Yeah, you got to check out the actual mechanism because I think you described it really well. You'll see that there is a space in the super tug toward the rear of the vehicle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they back into that, those front wheels of the plane. And a little bar comes out that surrounds the other side, closes the opening. And it looks like they can't lift that entire plane, but, as people in the 50s would say, by gum, they have.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And of course, it's all hydraulic, you know, so that's how that works. But, you know, one way to describe these vehicles, and I thought this was a pretty clever way to say it, and they do look really cool. These super tugs do. Almost a bit of a hot rod look to them in a way.
Cause they're so low slung.
Yeah, they are. They're real, real low and wide, and they've got, you know, just all these extra attachments, but they describe it as the unholy matrimony of a Hummer and a Batmobile.
Mm-hmm.
And with the strength and weight ratio of an ant. Which says a lot. I mean, they're super, super strong. It is kind of strange to see this little relatively little vehicle. It's big when you're standing next to it, but it's relatively little compared to those giant planes. And,
oh, yeah.
And the thing is, they can haul them across an airport property fast. They can get them to, you know, a distant hangar or wherever. I've seen them really, really moving fast.
Or a stand, which is the name for the remote parking spaces.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they can take them long distances quickly. And that's what their main benefit is, but incredibly strong. Probably one of the coolest things on the lot, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple others that maybe are close, but for strength and utility, that's the one.
Well, we can't go until we talk about de-icing vehicles.
Though. De-icing, of course. Yeah, that's now they have big booms, kind of like what you see on a cherry picker or something like that, and they just spray the de-icing fluid all over the body of the plane so that, you know, when they're parked or when they're ready for takeoff or waiting for takeoff, ice doesn't develop on, you know, some of the movable surfaces because that would cause a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. I've been on a plane before where they were de-icing in Michigan, and I'm sitting near the front of the plane, and it's right where the door is. And one of the seals was bad, and the de-icing fluid was coming into the plane.
Holy smokes.
And I remember it had a color to it. I don't know if it was purple or blue. I don't remember, but it was pouring into the thing. And I right away alerted the flight attendant. That's it. I got the old school version of that. I take a lot of heat for that at home, by the way.
Do you, really?
I say stewardess. I say waitress. I know I shouldn't, but I do.
I try to catch myself, but what it ends up, you know, what'll end up happening is I'll say, oh, maybe we should ask our wet server.
Yeah, yep.
You know?
To avoid the argument.
It's not necessarily even some argument for tradition or something. I think it's just I'm a lazy speaker and I pick up old habits.
Yeah, I guess it's just habit in my case because
I'm just old enough that there were still stewards and stewardesses.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I flagged
when
one
I was
down.
A kid.
Oh, yeah, you're right. When you're a kid, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think for a while it's been kind of the norm is to switch over to the more PC terms, right?
Yeah, and I think that there is a position called the steward who would be the head of the flight attendants.
I think you're right, but I don't know if that's the case anymore. I wonder if that's still true. Maybe not. Anyway. All right, so I flagged somebody down right away, and they actually came out and took a look at the seal or fixed whatever it was. That was kind of scary to see that stuff pouring through there like that. I can't imagine what would happen if you're in flight and that's, you know, it'd be like having a window cracked the whole way there.
That's terrifying, yeah. Especially if you get into a high altitude area.
Yeah. I mean, it's really rushing in there. So that's kind of bad. But anyways, that's a cool thing. It's a cool thing to watch. If you ever see it happening, you know, from outside the plane, it's really interesting.
And there's one more to talk about. Speaking of disasters, things going wrong.
Yeah.
Who do you call when it hits the fan?
The firefighters, the airline rescue and fire, or aircraft rescue and firefighting equipment, I guess, those guys. And of course, they have special training, right? Firefighting training. And it's not like your typical training, really, because it's completely different when you're trying to evacuate people quickly off of a big metal tube. Yeah, it's just a whole different set of circumstances surrounding everything around the airport. And one thing that I think about these that I can't let pass.
What's that?
Is that I feel like every time I see one of these vehicles, they look like something out of a sci-fi movie. They look so unusual, so different from a standard fire engine that it's remarkable. I mean, they really do look like something completely futuristic, and it's really cool to see it.
Yeah, with the big rounded cabs, the front of the trucks.
Yeah, high visibility, and they're very low. They're very squat vehicles, like everything has to be to get, again, under wings or wherever they need to be. But those
are some of the newer models because they're still very boxy ones from the 70s.
Oh, sure, yeah. And I mean, even the boxy ones, though, I mean, I still like the look of those even. Those are different from the ones that were on the road in the 70s. They're proportionally different. You know, they're more upright here on the streets. And at the airport, it's like they're squished down. It's almost like someone put their hand on top and just pushed down until they got this shape.
And these are perhaps the most vital of all airport support vehicles because just consider what happens if a fire breaks out on an aircraft and it's near fuel and it's also near, what, a dozen other aircraft easily?
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many people on board. And again, there's only a couple of exits, really. I mean, it's really important that they are quick and extremely skilled at what they do. You see a lot of times where they will come out and immediately cover the whole thing in foam and people are evacuating in foam or whatever. It's really a different. Again, it's all different out there on the runway versus here in the city, maybe, or, you know, out in the country.
Yeah,
it really is. The last thing that I want to mention, Ben, I know you said that was the last one, but there's one more quick thing that I'd like to mention here, and we had mentioned it early on in the show.
Oh, what is it?
The item that we're not going to be able to give a lot of attention to, and that was the snow removal equipment that our listener Dick B wanted to hear about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that these probably deserve a full episode of their own because it really is an important part of this whole thing in the certain climates, I guess.
Sure.
Here in Atlanta, we occasionally have use for snow equipment, and that's why we have very little snow equipment here is because it's just not needed. This year, in fact, we had no snow days. Sometimes we have three or four snow days, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But up in the north, you know, they can go on for months and months and months and, you know, all around the world, of course. And some places, if they have a lot of snow every year, they're going to have, you know, 100 or more pieces of snow removal equipment on hand, and they're going to have extremely heavy duty stuff too. I mean, like, you know, just the biggest snow removal machines you can imagine, all different types. You know, there's going to be types with plows. There're going to be some with brushes. There're going to be some that are snow blower type equipment, you know, that will actually remove the snow. Some that are just pushing the snow.
Yeah.
And one thing that I really found interesting about this is that I didn't know this, Ben, until I read it just yesterday. Airports have plows that have polyurethane blades instead of metal blades.
Huh.
And that is so that they don't damage the surface of the runway when they're doing their job. Because on the highway, I mean, that's passable. It's, you know, for longevity, so they last longer.
Right.
But it also tears up the road, you know, pretty bad.
I imagine so,
That cannot happen on an airport runway. I mean, it's got to be treated very gently. They got to, you know, cover every situation, you know, make sure that it's not going to cause any unnecessary stress on the surface. And those polyurethane blades do that. They help with it. But there's all kinds of stuff that they do ahead of time too that we probably don't even see. They use liquid sprayers to lay down, a brine solution so that, you know, they kind of pre-treat the ground.
Yeah.
So it won't freeze. It makes it easier later. Some places have spinning brush trucks, you know, it kind of depends on the type of snow too. The spinning brush type trucks work better if you have a light, light, airy, dry kind of snow.
Uh-huh.
But if you get lots of heavy, wet snow, like think about, you know, lake effect snow that comes off of, you know, over in like Buffalo, New York or something, they're going to have the real heavy plows because they get real heavy, wet snow that can't be just brushed away.
I see. Yeah.
So that's all very specialized as well. And it takes a long time and a lot of coordination. I'm sure that Dick could tell us all about this, but so much coordination is needed for this because they've got to shut down certain lanes of the airport at certain times, and then just minutes later they have to shut it down again to you know reapply or you know plow again or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's this continual cycle of planning and coordination that has to go on. So I have a lot of respect for the people that do that type of work.
It never stops.
It's just an incredible orchestration of events that has to happen to make it really work in a smart way.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep everybody safe, too.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So all these things, they all have their own purpose, and they all seem like they'd be really fun to drive, maybe with a couple of exceptions. But I was actually pretty impressed with the amount and what these vehicles do.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that there were quite so many vehicles that were required on an airport. And then when you think, well, when you're looking out the window, you might see 100 vehicles, you know, at any given point darting here and to and fro. How many are really there? How many are on the property?
I'd like to hear some more about the snow removal vehicles from Dick himself. So, Dick, if you're listening, drop us a line. Let us know what the average day was like. You know, when does it start? How long is the shift? What vehicles do you run into the most? And are there – or don't let me get you in trouble, man, but you know how sometimes there will be, like, stereotypes of different people's jobs, you know? In corporate America, people might say like, oh, here's the HR guy or the PR person or whatever. Is there anything like that among airport support vehicles?
Hmm.
Because I had heard the phrase before. I was talking to a friend of mine who works in the airline industry, and she used the phrase ramp rats. And I was like, what is a ramp rat? And I said, that doesn't sound like it's a very positive phrase.
No.
No,
it doesn't.
And I'm still not sure what it is, but I would like to hear it. And, of course, I'm asking what that phrase means. I get the sense that it's derogatory.
It sure does sound that way, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound like it doesn't sound like high praise.
It doesn't sound like something a group would call themselves either. It sounds like it's what other people would refer to someone else as, right? And, you know, Dick sent in a bunch of these photos too. He must have sent in half a dozen or more photos of the equipment. These are photos that he took of the equipment that he used. Really, really impressive. Some huge, huge snow plows and snow blowing equipment. Just, it's fascinating stuff. And really, all these vehicles, I mean, the Super Tugs are interesting, of course, because of what they are. They're so incredible. Just an amazing machine.
Just from an engineering perspective.
But everything really has its own place again. And again, every one of them has their own, trait or characteristic that makes them unique or interesting in some way. So I hope, maybe as you're following along here, you were looking them up online to see what we were talking about.
Yeah.
I hope you were, because that helps a lot. We try to describe what we can, but, you know, theater of the mind, we do what we can, you know, as much as we can.
Maybe you're listening to this as you're working, in which case, get back on the radio, man. if you're driving on the ramp right now.
Good point. Yeah, that's right. Don't be too distracted by what we're saying. And also, you know, if there's some that we've forgotten, I mean, I'd love to hear about, you know, additional vehicles that are out there. You know, we're talking about powered equipment that we're just neglecting, because I know there's others that didn't make the list.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear some of those too from listeners.
Yeah, and you can tell us about those on Twitter and on Facebook, where we are CarStuffHSW at both. You can also check out every episode we have ever done, and oh brother, there's a lot. We're carstuffshow.com, and if you want to take a page from Dick's book and email us directly, we'd love to hear from you. Our address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.